It is John Schramm and Larry Rasmussen introduced this session with a title, What Would It Mean to Be a Confessing Church Today? I'd like to clarify the nature of this session first. He introduced it by saying John Schramm will lead a discussion. I think that's fairly accurate. There are some sessions where you can announce it, so-and-so will have a session on, and you can assume that that's primary lecture. Then sometimes in the evening there is a forum, and that means there shouldn't be much from this chair at all. We should just start, and all this chair should do is moderate. This one is somewhat in between. Lead a discussion means that I feel that we've had a day of, in fact, if you've been here longer than that, 2 weeks of sessions that have to do with status confessionis, if you ever heard that word before, the confessing church, the 450th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession, this morning the history of that original event, this afternoon one of the recent times when that was used within the Lutheran Church, namely the confessing church in Germany, the names of Martin Niemöller and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We have had a lot of talk about South Africa and about Lutherans in South Africa saying they are standing in a position or a state of confession, status confessionis, as over against apartheid. In fact, they have invited the church in the United States and throughout the world to say we stand with you on that issue. We've had all of that input. This should be the time when you get a chance to say what that means to you, particularly what that means as far as where you stand in regard to your confession. I'm not going to tell you what a confessing church ought to be. I hope to give enough information that you are encouraged, in fact, pushed to decide what that would mean for you today. I think that's important to do. I think it's always easier to look back in history and to study a time when there was a confessing church. If it's contemporary, then it's easier to look over there, South Africa, and to decide whether or not they are, in fact, in a status confessionis, or should be. The hardest is to somehow find the place where we stand. First of all, history gives some objective, some perspective on it, so we can go back and, I guess Monday morning quarterback is not an inept term for easier to call the shots when the game is over. And when it's over there, you can kind of be out of it and study it more objectively. So those same people, these people, who celebrate the Boston Tea Party get very upset if there's a boycott today over injustice. They were patriots. If it happens today, they're troublemakers. We can celebrate the revolution of the United States and have a very hard time finding justifiable reason for revolt today in the world. I think that's natural. I think we ought to recognize it. I think also that should not keep us from finding out what a confessing church would be today in the world. I'm going to go back to several of the sessions today just a little bit. If you were here for the Larry Rasmussen session, now I'm asking you. There's a quiz. First of all, I'm going to see if you're out there and if you're alert and if you're willing to talk. If you were not here, the reason I'm asking the people who were here is so that you can be informed. What are the various uses of the word confession? Name one.
Professing faith.
Okay. How would professing your faith? Use that in a sentence. Use the word confession when it means to profess your faith. I confess that I believe in Jesus Christ. Or the name of the celebration today, the Augsburg Confession. It was a way in which they professed or gave public testimony to their faith. Another word, another way we use confession. Apostles' Creed is a confession of faith. Good. Get a different meaning now.
Acknowledging sin.
Acknowledging your sin. In the front of the LBW, and each week at Holden Village, we have a service of corporate confession. That's when we acknowledge our sinfulness. That's a legitimate use of the word confession. The fact that this is the case makes what would a confessing church today be, makes that question confusing unless we clarify it. That I think we ought to do so that we're talking about the same thing. You probably would have differences of opinion no matter which way we use the word confession. we might all agree the church today ought to be a church that confesses, meaning acknowledges sin. I think if we push it a little bit, we'd get to some points of disagreement, for instance. Some might mean by that the church today ought to follow Carl Menninger's book that asks, whatever happened to sin? And the church today ought to be willing to name sin and sinners. We're too permissive. I get information from church groups that say that very strongly. In other words, the church today ought to lead people to confess their sins, and we'd be stronger if we would do that. Some other people, when they said the church ought to be a confessing church, namely acknowledge sin, would mean that corporately the church, now I'm going to talk most from here on, I'm going to talk about us in the United States in this year, not past and not over there. That's the first clarification. If you didn't feel that, I didn't want to sneak that in as though I wasn't being honest with you. That's what we're talking about. Other people might mean by that, the church should in fact confess its corporate sinfulness, that we are too enculturated. We've used that word today. I'm going to stop and make sure we know what that means. What does that say to you if I would say some people are saying the church itself ought to confess that we have been too enculturated? Anybody want to give a try?
Too worldly?
Reflection of our culture.
That we reflect our culture too much, I guess.
If you, compromising.
Compromising, okay.
Homogenous
with the world around you, can't tell the difference between Christians and non-Christians. All right.
Too pale.
Too pale, all right. Lukewarm, neither hot nor cold. Okay. And so I think we could, first of all, say the church ought to be a confessing church and acknowledge our sin, and then find that we meant different things by that. Or if you take profession of faith, I would think that having acknowledged that any time in the history of the world, the church should be a church that professes its faith, if you'd push a little bit farther, you'd probably have a vast disagreement about what it meant to be faithful, about degrees of orthodoxy, about how you best proclaim Jesus Christ and the church. In other words, we'd probably have some differences after we agreed upon that. The point of today's discussion up until now, however, has been on a somewhat limited meaning of what it would mean to be a confessing church. I'm going to take this more limited meaning tonight, at least to begin the discussion, and then if you want to branch into either of those other two, okay. Historically, the phrase from the time of the confessing church in Germany, from the Formula of Concord and the Augsburg Confession, where it said there was the possibility of status confessionis, especially in South Africa today, it has a somewhat different meaning, and I would like to clarify that first and then talk to that about what it would mean to be that kind of confessing church today. Let me clarify first the difference between status confessionis and confessing church. Status confessionis is primarily, and somebody who knows the formula of Concord better than I or has a sharper way to say this, please come in. Status confessionis is primarily when the church assembled by vote, by consensus, by widespread understanding, comes to an agreement and speaks to the state. Status confessionis is when there is widespread general agreement on the part of the church, and they say to the state, whereas for the most part, social issues, matters of ethics are up to individual Christian conscience, and within the Christian church there can be a variety of opinions. Once in a while, there is a situation, a condition, or a mark of oppression that is not optional, where we say it is part of the very nature of what it means to be a Christian to come down on one side of that issue. That has not been done often in the history of the Christian church. Let me say what it means, status confessionis. Once in a while, there's an issue where the mark of your orthodoxy is determined by where you stand on that issue. Once in a while, that which we tend to think of as a social, political, economic option gets into the status of baptism, the Lordship of Christ, Jesus is my Savior. It gets the status of the position of the mark of faith, the mark of orthodoxy. Can you understand that? You're just kind of looking at me. Do you understand? That was the statement of blacks in South Africa. By the way, status confessionis is always stated by those who are suffering that particular oppression. Somebody else doesn't say, you're in status confessionis. It's the church in that situation that declares it. The rest of the world can say, we stand with you or not. But it isn't for us to judge whether we think apartheid is status confessionis. It's those suffering under it. They state it. Now you either stand with them or you don't. But it isn't up to you to say, I don't think you are, friend. That's up to them in good Lutheran theology to say it. The confessing movement is a little different from that. Now I want to have you feel the difference. The confessing movement is a portion of the church speaking to the wider church. Status confessionis was the church in agreement speaking to the state. The confessing church is a portion, a minority, or a segment of the church addressing the whole church that has not yet come to a conclusion about a particular situation being a matter of the faith. The confessing movement then tends to be a dissident group, a group that calls the rest of the church into a position that they have determined is faithful, and they are asking the rest of the church to come to that kind of conclusion. So it was Bonhoeffer and a confessing church speaking to the state church of Germany, to the rest of the Lutherans and the rest of the Christians, and telling them this is a matter of faith. In both of those situations, South Africa and Germany, it had to do very largely with a form of racism. In South Africa, it is by law that blacks must be separated from whites. That's what the blacks in South Africa are saying. Now it's a matter of faith. That's a denial of the gospel. When it's the official policy that races must be separated, you cannot be a Christian and line up with that kind of separation. In the German situation, what was it? It was that Jews, just by being Jews, were a kind of despised race. And so Bonhoeffer, when he said there is no Orthodox Christianity, there is no authentic gospel in Germany except in the confessing church, he is saying that that business of opposing Holocaust, of opposing genocide, and the eradication of the Jews now has become a matter of the faith. Got that distinction? In the United States today, what would it be to be a confessing church? My first answer, on the basis of the two illustrations in history that we've received, is that there is not at the present time, as I see it, historical reason to say there is a confessing church in the United States, or should be. Why? It is not the official policy of the United States of America in any of those regards that there is some official policy contrary to the gospel. You might say there are practices contrary to the gospel, but I don't think, like Nazi Germany and like South Africa, it is the official policy of the United States. Secondly, in the United States today, if there is a matter that for you is crucial to the faith, and some particular denomination does not have that as a strong stand, by and large, you can find a group which is free to operate within the United States that does have that as a strong stand. Let me give you an illustration. Let's say you are much stronger on the whole matter of disarmament, peace, conscientious objection than the Lutheran Church is. You are free to join the Mennonite, Quaker, Brethren, historic peace churches, and unless the new social or the new military system or draft registration or whatever is coming along, unless it's different from the past, there will be within the structure of the United States, the chance for you to be a conscientious objector. In other words, the United States built in the possibility of conscience and the respect of conscience. At the present time, I do not see that there is a situation in the United States similar to the others. Does that mean the forum's over? Well, I feel that what this forum does at the end of today and at the end of the last week nominates as one of the most crucial things facing you and me and the church in the next decade is the relationship of church and society, the relationship of church and government, the whole matter of my responsibility of faithfulness to Jesus Christ and what that means about my participation in and allegiance to the government in which I live, namely this one, the United States of America. I think that's a good discussion point, and I think that's what tackling the question means today. Let me recommend that there is perhaps a spectrum. I think I could have 6 or 7 points on it. In fact, if there were 25 of you here, I was going to have you line up from that corner of the room to that corner of the room on a literal spectrum here, begin to talk to one another, find where you really were with people that thought the same as you, move for 5 minutes, and then we'd see, first of all, we'd see that within this room, there was the whole spectrum of attitude, and we're all still going to celebrate the Eucharist tonight. That wouldn't be a bad experience. You probably have that whole spectrum in your church already. You just don't talk about it very often in Lutheran churches. And I think it's the thing that we ought to talk about. What would the spectrum be? Oh, something. There's just lines on the board. You're not missing anything yet. So if you listen, okay. Something like equating the American way of life and Christianity. I mean, you've got to say something that's way over here. Equating the American way of life and the Christian faith. I get some literature that almost does that without any apology at all. Move over a little bit. That American values, historically and presently, are probably as close to the values of the Christian faith as has ever happened, or at least as close as you can find them in the world today. Therefore, what we really ought to do is, instead of being a confessing church, thank God that we live here, understand why I would be a confessing church if I were in a communist country or a socialist country or an un-American country, give thanks to God, start with our prayers, thank you, God, that first of all, we're Americans, and go on from there. Something like that. Now keep moving on the spectrum. That the American way of life and built into our Constitution is at least enough freedom that we have the right, in our good conscience, to be who we are. Other people have the right, so at least America and its system allows us to be true to our own conscience. That's not equating Americanism, but it's saying we ought to be thankful that this is a very free country. Now keep moving. That the primary thing about the United States of America is a separation of church and state, and that's the way it ought to be. I don't want to equate Christianity with American way of life. I want a doctrine of two kingdoms. That's the best way to be Lutheran, and don't ever let the two mix. Keep moving. That there are many aspects of the American way of life that are contrary to the highest values of the Christian faith, but they do not prevent or prohibit me from living out my Christian life here. Keep moving. What's the next one? You do the next one. Can you sense what I'm doing on the spectrum? All of these opinions are in our... I'm not sure all of them are in this room, but I bet they are, really. Keep moving. What's the next one?
Alienation from American... total separation between church and state, not only informed, but also a feeling that the American way of life is an alienation to the highest ideal.
Okay. The American dream and the American values are so contrary to the Christian values that if I live in this country, I really have to continue to be a dissenter from them. I have to stand in contradiction to them. The present time, I probably won't go to jail for standing in contradiction to them. In fact, some groups, Mennonites and others, and I don't know about Jehovah's Witness, may even have tax refusal, and they might go to jail for that, but you're not persecuted like some other place. Far end of the spectrum would be what? The Christian life, as I understand it, is so violated by the American way of life that in order to be a Christian, I would have to be a confessing church. I would have to stand against the American way of life in order to be faithful. Some such statement over there. First of all, I doubt if in this room somebody would have gone to that corner or that corner. If so, please speak up, because it'll make for a great forum. We probably would phrase it a little more moderately and be somewhere in between there. Okay. Now let me tell you what I see coming within my lifetime, and then you can jump in. I think that the American experience was, for the most part, until quite recently, until my adult years, pretty much over here in regard to the Lutheran impressions and the official writings of most Protestant and major denominations, that we thought this was a Christian nation and said so, that at least it was a nation that offered us lots of freedom, and we, if not equate, if we did not equate American way of life and Christianity, we at least had a lot of overlaps. In fact, you still get some push for prayer in school and Thanksgiving observances and baccalaureates as part of the high school. And in some communities, there is no embarrassment to that at all. In fact, there are people lobbying in Congress for more of that to take place, for us to become. There was just an America for Jesus assembly in Washington, D.C. that combined crosses, the word Jesus, the American flag, and the American way of life. I think in the last 10 or 20 years, there has been more questioning of that, and I want to name a few of the things that I think are calling that into question and that we must struggle with. 2 years ago, the theme book at Holden was a theological book called Lighten Our Darkness. The author is Douglas John Hall. That was a theological book that said the major task confronting the church in North America today, the primary theological task confronting the church in North America today, is to question the American dream. Theologically, that book took to task the dream of mastery and of us building a kingdom with our own resources. It was heavily Lutheran, even though the author is from Canada and is of Calvinist background. The subtitle is Toward an Indigenous Theology of the Cross. And the quotes from Luther include the last thing Luther said, wir sind Bettler, das ist wahr. We are beggars, and that is true. The author was saying the American dream and the gospel of Jesus Christ and an understanding of us as creatures of God are on a collision course. Not some political soapbox, hippie kid in DuPont Circle or San Francisco, but a respected theologian taking on theologically the assumption of merging closely the American dream and the Christian way of life. William Stringfellow wrote a book published by Word Publishers of Texas. Interesting combination. If you know William Stringfellow and you know Word Publishers, that's an interesting combination. The title is Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange Land. Mr. Stringfellow said that we will get nowhere in understanding our Christian hope as long as we think that finally we live in Jerusalem, that this is the promised land. Until we are able to say this too is Babylon and name it, we will never understand the Christian hope or really be alive. The first step of life is resistance to Babylon, wherever you live, and this too is Babylon. That's theological language that calls into question. That's the beginning of a kind of dissent. Sojourners Magazine started out with another name, Post-American. That's already language that's much more like a confessing movement. Is Larry here? What was it before it was a confessing church?
Yeah, confessing movement.
All right, that's more like a few clergy and laymen who get together and begin to question. I would call Sojourners and the Post-American. What kinds of things do they write? Well, I brought one article by Jim Wallace, who is still the editor of that magazine. These are the kinds of things they write. Christians are to live in distinction from the false values of the society around them. The church needs to structure an environment where that's possible. Christians need this, he suggested, to survive in a society that is hostile to the gospel of Christ. And he says the United States is. See, that's when you're meddling. We could agree about that back there or over there. The struggle is that true here or not? Basically, we've been brought up to say, no, that's not true here. I'm just telling you there are more people saying it is. In the preaching of repentance and forgiveness, he noted we need to give people something to turn to as well as to turn from. His primary thrust, I guess I ought to quote it so I'm not paraphrasing it. A whole generation has become convinced that a commitment to Jesus Christ is the way one becomes successful in terms of our culture. He feels that's a primary denial of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That if you have the impression, I'm going to quote a theologian. Mark Spitz's father is a theologian. When Mark won 5 gold medals, Mark Spitz's father said publicly, God loves a winner. I'm delighted that Mark's father was proud of Mark. I disagree 100% with the theology of his being proud of his son. Wir sind Bettler, das ist wahr. That's Luther. We are beggars, that is true. God loves a winner. If you push that one, you're going to have a burden on your shoulders that is simply overwhelming, because the first time you are not a winner, you're in real trouble. I want a gospel that says even when I'm not a winner, even when I'm a teenager with pimples, God still loves me. Mark Spitz's father, I don't mean to pick on him, he wasn't even trying to be a theologian, but I'm just telling you, Jim Wallace could have said, the kind of culture that let the father of an athlete say that so freely and everybody thought, isn't that great how much he loves Mark, is a dangerous denial of the gospel, and you have to stand against it. Secondly, the church dare not be a community where people gather to have their own needs met. You analyze the church today, and Jim Wallace would say there is so much in the church that tries to have everybody adjusted. Well-adjusted, calm, happy, successful. If the culture is not a Christian culture, the last thing in the world is that you get adjusted to it. You ought to feel more and more unadjusted every time you hear the gospel if, in fact, the culture doesn't have the gospel values. Do you feel the difference? You can argue with him, but at least listen to him. Maybe the last thing in the world today in the United States is for you to ask your pastor to help you feel more adjusted. Wallace says that's true. Other people just say, treason, Mr. Wallace. Subversive, Mr. Wallace. That's why I think we might have some discussion at this point. Kind of thing that I think is the minimum step that we ought to take toward considering whether or not we are to be a confessing movement is to say the one thing for sure is that I should first of all see biblically. I should first of all have allegiance to Jesus Christ. Nothing else before that. And I'm not sure we've even taken that step in the church. William Stringfellow said, I want to see my country biblically. I do not want to see my Bible Americanly. If you don't understand that, then by all means, let's talk about that before you leave. I think that's good theology. Don't miss what he's telling you to do. In other words, what I always do is to try to get people to be more of a monk than they were before I met them. A monk is one who is disillusioned. A monk is one who stands in contradiction to any prevailing value in the world around him that's contrary to Jesus Christ. A contemplative monk is not somebody who sees a different world. He is someone who sees this world differently. And if we don't have that, we're not the church. So there's lots of questions that might come, second, third, and fourth. The first one is, what does faithfulness to Jesus Christ mean? Don't ignore the monks. I'm going to give you I'm going to give you one brief devotion by a monk, and then open it up. Thomas Merton. One of the most disturbing facts that came out in the Eichmann trial was that a psychiatrist examined him and pronounced that he was perfectly sane. I do not doubt it at all. That is precisely why I find it so disturbing. If all the Nazis had been psychotics, as some of their leaders probably were, their appalling cruelty would have been in some sense easier to understand. It is much worse to consider calm, well-balanced, unperturbed, an official conscientiously going about his task, his administrative job, which happened to be the supervision of mass murder. Eichmann was thoughtful, orderly, unimaginative, had a profound respect for the system, a profound respect for law and order. He was obedient, loyal, faithful officer of a great state. He served his government very well. He was not even bothered by guilt. He developed no psychosomatic illnesses, and he slept well. He had a good appetite, so it seems, and he passed all the Rorschach tests. Now it begins to dawn on us that it is precisely the sane ones in the world who are the most dangerous. It's the sane ones, and it's the well-adapted ones who can, without qualms and without nausea, aim missiles and press the buttons that will initiate the great festival of destruction that they, the sane ones, have prepared. You can rest assured that the one who punches the button will have been examined by psychiatrists and will be perfectly sane. What makes us so sure, after all, that the danger comes from a psychotic getting into the position to fire the first shot in a nuclear war? Psychotics will be suspect. It's the sane ones that will keep them far from the buttons. We can no longer assume that because a man is sane, he is therefore in his right mind. The whole concept of sanity in a society where spiritual values have lost their meaning is itself meaningless. A man can be sane in the limited sense that he is not impeded by his disordered emotions from acting in a cool, orderly manner according to the needs and dictates of the social situation in which he finds himself. He can be perfectly adjusted, God knows. Perhaps such people can be perfectly adjusted even in hell. I am beginning to realize that sanity is no longer a value or an end in itself. Every time he has sanity, he has it in quotes, by the way, in fairness to him. The sanity of modern man is about as useful to him as the huge bulk and muscles of the dinosaur. If he were a little less sane, if he were a little more doubtful, if he were a little more aware of absurdities and contradictions, perhaps there might be a possibility of his survival. But if he is too sane, perhaps we must say that in a society like ours, the worst insanity is to be totally without anxiety, to be totally sane. I consider Thomas Merton a monk, and I consider Thomas Merton always part of at least the potential confessing movement, and you now know that I'm a little over there on that spectrum of 0 to 10. But it's your evening from here on. Yes?
I would say that we're caught in a system in which we have to pay taxes, and a lot of our taxes go for things that are anti-Christian, such as the missiles and the Trident submarines that you mentioned, and that maybe some way we could try to be more Christian is to write to our congresspeople and to say, as a Christian, I'm not sure that I want my money to go towards this, and then to educate ourselves on nonviolent ways, because I know the question is, well, how do we defend ourselves? And I guess my answer is a real, some people would call it a naive answer, in which I would just say, well, the Bible says thou shalt not kill, so I would rather not have any kind of defense. And I know that, you know, might be unrealistic, but I would just look into the regular taxes that we pay every day, maybe unthinkingly, and where is our money going to? What are we doing? Just by our silence.
Can I use that as an illustration? The reason that I said I do not feel we're at the point of the necessity of a confessing church at this point is your answer includes where you stand in conscience. It also gave some options for you to state that conscience. And at this point, you can say perhaps that's frustrating that you don't get the answer you want, but you still have, without being clobbered, jailed, or killed for it, the right to express your conscience. So what I'm saying is, in the United States today, I think we still have the opportunity to stand where we wish, and it is not against the law to stand there. You might suffer for certain acts of civil disobedience, but you can still express your conscience. So at the present time, what it means to be a confessing movement is for you to express your conscience. Historically, if you were no longer allowed to do that, then there would be the talk of, must we become a confessing church in order to be faithful to the conscience? I'm not going to do that every time, but do you feel the difference between a situation where you are allowed to be, you're allowed to express yourself to elected officials, you have the right to vote for officials that stand where you stand, you have the option of tax resistance, there are some penalties to that. You, in other words, today in the United States, your conscience is respected in the regards that I have stated. The countries where that's not the case, the church doesn't have the options and therefore moves more quickly to a confessing church. I'm just trying to clarify what I said before. I'm not sure
I think I'm confused in what you're saying. I'm just saying that for myself, as a Christian person, I'm glad that I do have the freedoms that I have. But as a Christian person, I think every day of the things that I probably do that are unchristian through my silence.
Okay. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm trying to use it as an illustration for our discussion.
If indeed the determination was that the Lutheran position was a position historically of selective conscientious objection, how would you pursue that as the point at which we become a confessing church?
Do you know the historical background to Bob's statement? The selective service system in the United States puts a real burden on Lutheran young people, in fact, on most Christian young people in the United States. The Selective Service Act allows conscientious objection only to those who are opposed to war in all form. In other words, only to those who are members of the peace churches, the pacifist, Mennonite, Brethren, and Quaker. The local draft board previously, we haven't had a draft since 72. The draft boards could not, by statute, give conscientious objection status to selective conscientious objectors. But the historic position of Lutherans in regard to peace war was justifiable war. In other words, it's up to every Lutheran group and individual to judge every war. And therefore, if a Lutheran young person said, this one is not justifiable, like Vietnam, but had to answer the draft board, had I been living in World War II, I would have gone to war, they couldn't be a conscientious objector, because they had to say, I'm opposed to war in all forms. It's a bind. Whether or not, right now there are movements to include selective conscientious objection. First of all, our government still has the way in which the Lutheran Church, if it wished to express itself and get selective service change, you can't say we made a big effort to do that and got turned down. That would be the first step, to have the selective service system respect Lutheran consciences. And what group would you have with you? All Roman Catholics, Presbyterians, Baptists, Methodists, all but Mennonites, Brethren, and Quakers are in the same bind, but we have never spoken clearly to the government and to those who set up selective conscientious objection. If a church like Lutheran tried that and finally got nowhere at all, they might stand as a kind of confessing church over against a system that did not respect their conscience. Yes, I think that's historically accurate. If you didn't keep up with that, I can understand it. That's an awful lot of of history that includes Plato, Augustine, the development of 7 justifiable war criteria, and 1,900 years of history as Bob and I talked. So you might want to ask a little bit more about what we were talking about. But I think it's a case in point.
The very fact that we have very difficulty understanding what you're talking about seems to me would mean that we would have a great difficulty ever putting it across in the Lutheran Church. Because we don't think that way.
It would not take long for you. The main reason is Lutherans have not been clear on their stand regarding war historically. You ask the typical, you go up to a Lutheran friend, well, I could ask you, what are the criteria for a justifiable war? And I think you'll strike out 99 out of 100 times. We're not articulate about the historic Lutheran position. If we were, we would readily recognize the bind of a country that does not recognize selective conscientious objection. But yes, it'd be an uphill battle because we're not conversant in our own historical stand. That's correct.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
First, I want to tell a story.
All right.
The line, you mentioned the word insanity a while ago. The line between sanity and insanity is a very fine one. My brother likes to tell a story on himself. I don't know that the incident actually occurred involving him. But he had to be out of town. On the way back, he had to pass by the Western State Hospital, which we used to call the insane asylum. And he had a flat tire, and he pulled over to the side of the highway and jacked the car up and took the wheel off and put the nuts in a hubcap, and then pulled the wheel off to put the new tire on, spare tire on. And in doing so, he kicked the hubcap, and the hubcap and the nuts all fell into a deep ditch full of water, and he was in a dither, not knowing what to do. And he heard a voice speak to him, "In trouble, sir?" And he looked back around, and he saw an inmate leaning over the wall of the institution. And my brother said, "Yes, I am. I just lost all my nuts over in the ditch, and I don't know what to do." "Well," the fellow says, "I'll tell you what you do. You take one nut off the other three wheels. That'll hold your fourth wheel on until you can get to the garage." And my brother says, "Say, you're a pretty bright man to be in an insane asylum." And the fellow says, "Well, I might be insane, but I'm not stupid." Well, you were talking about, now I've forgotten what I was going to say. That's all so wrapped up in my story. It had to do with a nation sort of making up its mind what it is going to do. And I gather from what you said that it'd be pretty difficult for all the Lutheran churches to come to agreement on any serious issue. Did you intend to convey that impression?
Let me give you the impression that I meant to convey. The Lutheran Church in South Africa had very little difficulty coming to a consensus on apartheid. For the most part, the Lutheran Church in the United States today is in agreement as to matters of the faith, Augsburg Confession, and we are a confessional church, probably in comparison to other Protestant churches, have a bulk of profession of faith that we agree to. In the United States today, I think most social, political, and economic issues are still in the category of not of status confessionis for Lutherans. In other words, we have not said, you are not really Orthodox if you disagree with me in your politics. And I think that's the way it should be. If there were an issue that arose that meant some particular thing, like apartheid in South Africa, like the treatment of Jews in Nazi Germany, that meant some Lutherans thought, that's no longer optional. Lutherans can disagree about a lot of things. There is now this one thing that we cannot disagree on and still be Orthodox Christians. If that emerges, there would be the possibility of a confessing movement and a confessing church. I don't feel that right now in the United States. I have in my lifetime, especially the last 10 years, heard more and read more of people who think we might be moving to that than I did in earlier years. And I'm testing that with you. I think there are there are more people saying, and what areas do they come in? What are the potential areas? The first comment was militarism, nuclear armaments, and I think that might be a thing that, that would potentially be for some a matter of status confessionis. Our treatment of the environment, or what our technological society does in regard to the earth, was maybe more than now an environmental movement. Materialism and capitalism and profits, and whether or not that exploits other people, is an area where there is great difference. Nobody is saying at the present time that I know of that it's a matter of status confessionis, but those are the kind of areas where it would come, where somebody begins to say that one is so against my, the understanding of the Christian faith, that we're going to say you cannot be a Christian and have that opinion. Do you see? For the most part in Christian history, we have said, if you and I agree that Jesus is Lord and agree on the matters of faith, the other things can be disagreements, and we're both still Christian. Status confessionis says that one of those issues is so anti-gospel that it becomes a matter of the faith. That's what we're trying to get that through today in our understanding of the 450th anniversary of the Reformation. Have I?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Two people. Historians, did the church get close to that on slavery issue in the United States? Slavery.
Which church? I mean, several denominations split.
Okay.
Over the slavery issue. The Lutherans were not one of them.
Presbyterians north and south were Baptists?
Methodists.
Methodists.
Well, no, the Methodists did not. Excuse me. That's one exception of the church that was in both the north and the south. It did not split.
For that denomination, you're talking about the kind of things that it became enough of an issue that some people said your stand on that means that you are no longer Christian. That's a good illustration. But for the general population, the churches in the United States, it did not, right?
Joe Barn mentioned one small Lutheran group.
One small in the slavery issue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Franklin Synod of New York State.
Okay.
Slavery was established.
Yes.
The death penalty?
Death penalty. What do you think? Will it be? It's back as a current political issue. Have you heard enough feeling on the part of Lutheran people or Christian people that you think it might be status confessionis? I haven't.
No, I would just like to, you know, say that maybe that might be a... Maybe we should...
Let me tell you one of the things where Wallace kind of gets to me, Jim Wallace. He claims that it's much easier to clarify when it really must be status confessionis when you're in a country where Christians are persecuted. It's much harder to realize that maybe we ought to be a confessing movement when our problem is not persecution but seduction. I think he has a good point. I mean, when it's persecution, it's clear. When it's seduction, meaning we just more and more become inculturated, remember all the descriptions of inculturated? Then I think we ought to help ourselves be especially sensitive to the gospel and when we might lose it because of being inculturated. I appreciate your interest. I think it's a thing to struggle with, and I hope you got a start of it here at Holden. Thank you.